From Gallup Studios in Washington, D.C., this is Muhammad Yunus back with another episode of the Gallup Podcast. In this episode, we speak to LGBT rights activist Cleve Jones about the trajectory of LGBT rights in America and some of the milestones the movement has marked along the way. But first, we'll speak with our very own Justin McCarthy about Gallup's latest findings on Americans' opinions on LGBT rights in this episode's Data Dive. This week, the LGBT community celebrates the 50th anniversary of the 1969 Stonewall riots in New York City, a key event in the gay rights movement. Over the past month, Gallup has been releasing new findings on LGBT issues, as well as updates to questions dating back to the 1970s. Gallup analyst Justin McCarthy wrote about some of our latest data. Justin, what were our top line findings?
You know, a lot of people pay attention to our annual updates on approval of same-sex marriage, but some of our oldest findings predate a time when that wasn't even a goal for gay activists. It's not a coincidence that Gallup started polling on questions about gay and lesbian rights in 1977 because a lot was going on that year in gay rights. After the spontaneity of Stonewall, there was sort of a growing organization to the gay rights movement, and gay issues were beginning to bubble to the forefront, even for Americans who considered them taboo. So it was really interesting to compare our findings then and now.
So it's been 42 years since our first poll on this topic. What's changed?
Quite a bit has changed. I'll start with employment. That was a really big issue in the 70s. There were disagreements about whether gay people should be allowed to teach in elementary schools, for example. Just 27% said that a gay person should be allowed to be an elementary school teacher in 1977, but that figure has grown to 81% today. In terms of employment rights in general, In 1977, 56% said that gay people should have equal employment rights. But today, nearly all Americans agree with this, now at 93%. The other big one is the legality of same-sex relations. For a long time, until the Supreme Court's 2003 Lawrence v. Texas decision, gay people could be in prison for engaging in same-sex intimacy. And in 1977, Americans were split on the question of whether gay or lesbian relations between consenting adults should be legal, with 43% at the time saying it should be legal and 43% saying it shouldn't. Today, 83% agree that same-sex relations should be legal, which is almost twice as high as the percentage we found 42 years ago.
Amazing. I know you've been recently poring through all of our LGBT data beyond those that you used for your recent analyses. Are there any larger takeaways before I let you go?
I think this is a topic that Gallup has contributed a lot to, and we've evolved in what and how we ask about LGBT issues over the past several decades. We've adjusted question wordings, we've added questions about transgender Americans, we've sort of been an American time capsule on many issues in the U.S., and LGBT rights are no different. So it's been really interesting to study, especially upon this big anniversary for the community.
Justin, thank you for coming back on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Cleve Jones is an American human rights activist, author, and lecturer. Jones joined the gay liberation movement in the early 1970s. He was mentored by pioneer LGBT activist Harvey Milk and worked in Milk's City Hall office as a student intern until Milk's assassination in 1978. Jones co-founded the San Francisco AIDS Foundation in 1983 and founded the NAMES Project AIDS Memorial Quilt, one of the world's largest community arts projects, in 1987. His first book, Stitching a Revolution, was published by HarperCollins in 2000. Cleve, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
We were eager to speak with you, Cleve, because of how actively involved you've remained in advancing LGBT rights over key points throughout the gay rights movement here in America. Gallup first polled about gay people in 1977, which was an important time in your life. Your mentor, of course, gay rights icon Harvey Milk, was elected that year to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. This was within the first decade after the 1969 Stonewall riots, which took place about 50 years ago this month. Just for our viewers, our listeners, to really understand more context, tell us about what the Stonewall riots were about and how it influenced the drive and goals of you and other activists in the 1970s.
Well, the Stonewall Rebellion is certainly one of the most mythologized incidents in relatively recent history. It's sort of reimagined and reinterpreted by every generation. But for my generation, it was very much a symbol of a of a new kind of look, a way of looking at who we were. At that time, it's important for your listeners to understand, it was still a criminal offense for adults of the same gender to have sexual relationships. So the world that I came out into was a world where homosexuality was condemned as a crime, a sin, and a mental illness. And it would be years before that criminal status was ended and the psychiatrists and psychologists agreed it was no longer a disorder. And of course, the churches are still arguing about it. But for me, as a 15-year-old kid, I learned about the Stonewall Rebellion in an issue of Life magazine, and it absolutely changed my life because I understood for the very first time that there were other people like me, that there were good people like me, that there was a community and there was a movement and that people were fighting for their rights and their dignity.
And did you sort of carry that with you, I'm assuming, throughout the amazing journey you've taken through the rights movement? Was it something that young people who were in the gay community sort of started talking about more openly because it became like a public point of conversation in the news?
Well, prior to Stonewall and the beginning of the modern gay liberation movement, there was really almost no public discussion of the issue. People were very closeted. There were no role models. There were no openly gay newscasters or artists or, none of this existed. The only references one ever heard to the issue had to do with people who were being arrested or people who were in some sort of scandal. Mm-hmm. So it was a moment of great liberation and excitement. And the news, even prior to the internet, by many decades, the news spread rather quickly. So 1 year after the Stonewall Rebellion, we saw commemorative marches occur in a handful of cities. But 2 years later, they had moved to dozens and dozens of cities. And by the time I graduated from high school in 1972, just 3 years later, there were gay liberation groups on almost every campus in the United States and beginning to spread across Canada and throughout Europe as well. So it was a time of very explosive growth for the movement. I'm not exaggerating when I say that this saved my life, because we like to think we've made such great progress, but I'm sure that there are people listening right now who have young people in their lives who are considering taking their lives because of the hostility directed against gay people. And so I was one of those kids who had planned to commit suicide at 15. And when I learned about the movement, I flushed the pills down the toilet. And I thought, no, I'm not going to kill myself. I'm going to get the heck out of Phoenix and go to San Francisco.
Which is a really perfect segue to kind of what I was thinking when you were saying this, is it's also a really local thing. I mean, I grew up in Los Angeles, and I can imagine back in the day, Phoenix is very different than, modern Phoenix today. How much of moving to San Francisco, how much of what you were seeking when you moved to San Francisco did you find? And how much of it, let me put it this way, did you feel the movement still had to build in order to find a place for yourself, just as a person in the society?
When I got to San Francisco, I was one of many thousands of young queer kids who were arriving really every day. As the word got out that San Francisco was a special place for gay people, it really began to accelerate. And towards the end of the 1970s, 10 years after the Stonewall Rebellion, the migration was enormous and people were coming by the thousands from all over the country and indeed around the world. And a very interesting thing began to happen, which was that a movement that had begun with a movement that came out of really the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement during a period of great unrest in this country. I think many young people today are not aware of just how crazy it was in this country in 1968, 1969, at the height of the anti-war movement. The cities were burning, there were riots, there was the rise of the Black Panthers, women's liberation. So the gay liberation movement was you know, part of that whole experience. But then 10 years later, we were really beginning to create the social structures that were necessary to sustain a community, because it wasn't just about a movement, it was about a community. So about 10 years into the, after Stonewall, we began to see the creation of cultural institutions that would sustain the community and strengthen it and create a place where more people could participate. So one didn't have to be this long-haired radical firebrand that I was. One could be a social service provider or a clergy member or a teacher or an artist. And we began to build those institutions.
In 77 and kind of towards, you know, just shy of 10 years after Stonewall, Gallup actually found that back then, most Americans didn't think gay people should be hired as doctors or elementary school teachers. Public opinion has really changed quite a bit since then. But what was it like at the time for gay professionals who feared for their job security?
Well, I think this is still a serious issue. I think it is still a serious issue for the majority of people who identify as LGBT in this country today. And it is, I think, kind of one of the fascinating developments is that back then, you know, the idea that we would be allowed to serve in the military or marry our partners was just so, such a stretch, but we were already beginning to pass ordinances in different jurisdictions that gave some limited protection against job and housing discrimination. So it's kind of interesting that Gallup's polling over the decades has shown fairly consistent support for the idea that gay people should be allowed to work. And there's been, you know, fluctuations in terms of employment, like, you know, teachers.
Like different professions, yeah.
But generally speaking, the polling has shown for decades that Americans didn't think people should be discriminated against on the basis of their sexual orientation and housing and job and employment. But we're still not there. We got marriage equality. We got the right to serve in the military. But in over half of the states, one can still lose one's job just because of one's sexual orientation. And even in those jurisdictions like California and even in San Francisco, I know people who believe that if they were to reveal their true nature to their employer, they might not get immediately dismissed, but they might well be passed over for promotion. So it is still a serious issue.
Similarly to just the rights of other minority communities, you know, explicitly having the law passed that explicitly sort of prohibits, you know, outright discrimination, often falls short of addressing more latent and more subliminal, if you will, acts and systemic incidences of discrimination against people and employees in what we most would consider very liberal districts. I know even Los Angeles County, growing up just as a kid that was going to law school, had a series of challenges around this issue specifically, but around, you know, all other minority communities as well. So it absolutely remains an issue. And unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, living in a country where folks like you and others can sort of step up and address those challenges and human rights violations and shortcomings. Tell us about, you know, what you are involved in these days and what you see the movement really being more about in 2019. In this increasingly sort of polarized political environment?
Well, I have, for the last 15 years, most of my work has actually been within the labor movement. I work for the Hospitality Workers Union, Unite Here. Some of your listeners may have encountered our pickets around various Marriott hotels earlier in the, towards the end of last year. We had a massive strike against Marriott, but it kind of, this kind of work brings together sort of all of my interests because I'm not a single issue person. And I'm also interested in delivering real results. And one of the exciting things about being involved with the union is seeing how we are extending those protections, workplace protections, to LGBT people through collective bargaining. So even in states like Florida and Texas and Mississippi and Louisiana and Georgia, where their state legislatures are very unlikely to pass any such protections in the foreseeable future, through collective bargaining, we're actually winning contracts that do protect not only gay but transgender workers. So I find that very exciting. I also think that there are some overarching issues that certainly affect my community in very specific ways and sometimes kind of unique ways. But when we look at the big picture of what's going on in this country and around the world right now, I think it's very important for everybody to find their way to contribute to moving us forward and addressing the challenges of global warming, the incredible growing gap between rich and poor, the housing crisis. All of these things affect all of us. And it's becoming increasingly clear that we're approaching a very precipitous moment in history. So I hope that everybody can find a way to contribute the way I did, because the work I do has always brought me joy. And I think anybody that's listening who wants to be part of the solution, we all have some special gift we can bring to these struggles. And I was lucky because I found a way to do it that also brought me pleasure and connected me to wonderful people. And it has sustained me and kept me moving forward over the decades.
And it's really been amazing for me personally, you know, studying more closely all of the amazing things you've been involved in and the really critical moments of the movement over the past several decades. A lot of your work has been centered around AIDS activism. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that. It's not something I think that in today's world really gets as much focus maybe as previous generations, but you famously founded the AIDS Memorial Quilt. What effect did the AIDS crisis have on the direction of the gay rights movement? And is this still a challenge in the community? Maybe not perhaps in the US in the way that it used to be, but perhaps globally in the LGBT community?
Well, of course, the onset of the pandemic was devastating. And the decade and a half that followed before effective treatments became available was a nightmare for me and for everybody I knew. Here in San Francisco, we lost probably close to 25,000 gay men. I lost almost everybody I knew. And it struck us at a time and a place in a way that was really devastating, because the movement was still very young. It was very fragile, and it was very much a sexual liberation movement. And so you had all of these young men going to the big cities where the gay communities had begun to flourish. And of course, this was like a candy store experience for people. All of the repressed desires and longings were released. And so to have the pandemic just sort of stab right at the heart of what we were all about was really, there were many, many times I wondered if we would survive it. But I think also it changed us, because we experienced so much grief and so much suffering, and we had to organize in new ways. We had to raise sums of money that would have been just incomprehensible only a few years earlier. We had to really create those social institutions that I referenced earlier, because of course in most places in the early days of the epidemic, the government wasn't doing anything to help us. We were very much on our own. Exactly. So, you know, we created the meal delivery programs and the buddy programs and housing programs. We had to create all of this out of whole cloth, because we'd been so completely abandoned by the government. So that strengthened us and gave us skills. And those who did not die emerged from that period, I think, very much stronger. Many of us quite bitter and angry about what we saw as a betrayal from the government. But it also, I think, changed the way gay and lesbian people in particular look at each other and our relationships. There's a lot of kind of revisionist history going on that the focus of marriage equality was imposed on the community by the wealthy white guys that run the big national organizations. That's not really true. The push for marriage equality that was represented best by Edie Windsor and the challenge to California's Prop 8, this came from the grassroots. This came from ordinary working class, middle class people who had perhaps in the past dismissed marriage as, you know, that little piece of paper that I don't need. You know, people would say, I don't need the church to recognize my relationship, or I don't need the state to recognize my relationship. But in the course of the pandemic, we saw people die because they didn't have access to their partner's health insurance. We saw people who had lived together for 20 years, one partner dies and the other one is thrown out in the street by the family who arrives after, you know, 20 years of absence to claim the home. So we saw the evidence of how much that little piece of paper mattered. Yeah. But I also think it changed the way people looked at their relationships, and they said, what do you mean this isn't a marriage after all we've been through?
Yeah, it's what makes any marriage a marriage, right? Whether it's doing the chores I don't like or being there in those critical moments, like in someone's life, it's just...
If you're exactly.
In life, who's somebody else to tell you that that's not a, you know, it can't be recognized. I think it's, you know, it's, I'm so happy, Cleve, that you're sharing these experiences with us, because I think for a lot of younger listeners, it's really hard to imagine it or think about that kind of unfolding. We live in a world now, especially with how connected everything is on social media, where even if you live in an environment that is, even particularly homophobic, it's pretty easy to seek out information, connections, members of the community across the country, across the world, that offer you an alternative to that sort of hateful approach environment. It's striking to me. I mean, I'm about 38, so I remember some of the things you're referencing, but it's really remarkable how far the legal system has come, as you mentioned, you know, marriage specifically, but also just public attitudes. I mean, views on gay rights have really reflected some of the most dramatic shifts in public opinion that we've recorded at Gallup. So I just wanted to ask you, as we close off, standing where you are now, decades from the starting point of your career, what is it like having fought for and really witnessed this remarkable amount of change, knowing that, of course, much work remains to be done?
Oh, yes, of course, a lot of work remains. But I'll tell you, I'm very grateful to be alive. And when I look back at it, I'll be 65 soon, I really have seen this issue just transformed. And I think that the polling that Gallup has done over the years really, for me, it all proves that Harvey was right. The single most important thing any LGBT person could do to advance our cause is to come out, to live honestly and openly and reveal our true natures to our families, our friends, our neighbors, our colleagues and co-workers, our clergymen, because the hatred of homosexuals and transgender people is based on fear. It's all about not understanding. And the polling has shown us very clearly that over the decades, by coming out, and and it also has shown us that our greatest challenge is our greatest asset, which is our incredible diversity. So I think that we see progress at a much higher, at a faster speed than we've seen on, for example, combating racism, because queer and trans people are born into every color of skin, every faith background, every economic level, every political philosophy. So as we come out, that change is pervasive across the culture and is not contained within any one demographic subset. And then as we've come out and as we've seen our lives increasingly reflected by popular culture, that accelerated the process even more.
Well, I wanted to end on that note, but my producer, Justin, is now like flagging me. He's like, don't let him go without talking about Mayor Pete. So I have to ask you, since you start your career really with the most legendary gay politician in America, Harvey Milk. How do you feel about the fact that there is now a you know, mainstream candidate gaining a lot of national attention who is openly gay? And do you sort of see a path to victory for it?
I'm fascinated by Mayor Pete. I just met him for the first time last week here in San Francisco. And, you know, it's kind of funny to me that our, you know, first credible gay candidate for president is so much a Hoosier. I'm a Hoosier. I'm from Indiana. And, you know, it's kind of funny to me that this small town mayor who signed up to go fight in Afghanistan and who, you know, he is very, very mainstream and much more polished than Harvey ever was. But it's exciting to me, and I don't know that I'm going to vote for the guy, but I am proud that we have such an articulate person to emerge as our first credible candidate for president. I'm way to the left of Mayor Pete, as you might guess. But I'm still proud of him and grateful that he's doing such a good job.
Wonderful. On that note, Cleve, thank you so much for joining the podcast. It was a pleasure having you.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
And that's the podcast. Thank you for listening. To subscribe to the podcast on your mobile device from any podcast app, just search the Gallup Podcast. For more of our content, go to news.gallup.com or follow us at Gallup News. If you have questions or feedback on the show, write to us by emailing podcast@gallup.com. The Gallup Podcast is directed by Curtis Grubb and produced by Justin McCarthy.